Tuesday on LIS Radio, School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri-Columbia. And this is Karen Robinson, your host for this segment of First Tuesday. We're online with Rebecca Varga, president of the Special Libraries Association. Rebecca has served as librarian at the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, since 2001. She has told me that she has a checkered past, as she calls it, of library and educational type experience, and I'm going to ask her about that in a few minutes. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Karen. I really appreciate your kind introduction. I am so pleased to be with you this afternoon.
And we are glad to have you with us. This is such a special treat for us to have the president of the Special Libraries Association online with us on First Tuesday. Would you tell us a little bit about what you call your checkered past in your professional experience?
Thank you very much, Karen. Well, let me preface that with talking about SLA just a little bit.
Oh, yes.
SLA is a not-for-profit global organization for library and information professionals and their strategic partners. We have more than 11,000 members in the information profession, and that includes members in the academic, corporate, and government information arenas. Our association strengthens our members through learning, advocacy, and networking initiatives.
What is your focus for SLA this year, while during your tenure as president?
Well, and I'm glad you asked. Actually, my tenure, I have the opportunity and the honor of being president for 18 months, which is a little bit unusual.
Oh, that is nice.
In the association world. And two things that I have talked about a great deal when I visit our members, like the chapter in St. Louis in the Missouri area, I talk about membership in the association and the benefits, and also focusing on our centennial celebration. We will celebrate our 100th anniversary in 2009 in Washington, D.C.
Making 100 years of special libraries. I love this. This is great.
Yes.
Of course, I've been a special librarian for many years, so it warms my heart.
Exactly. And our publication, Information Outlook, has a fresh new look. What a difference 10 years makes. The January issue is reflecting the recreation with a spirit of renewal and positive evolution. And as we know, change is an integral part of libraries and information and, indeed, SLA culture. Our publication is 10 years old, and so we felt like that January 2007, the beginning of a new year, was an excellent place and time to unveil our new look. And so we have a new format, and this is an exciting change.
And this, now the new look will be on the Information Outlook, which is the official publication.
That is correct, and it's the January issue. It's the magazine of Special Libraries Association. So we had a lot of staff have worked very, very hard on this. We worked with an outside designer as well to develop and create an updated look. And the goal that we had was to create a modern look which appeals to the wide spectrum of our members, regardless of the specific industry or your level of experience in the profession. That was the goal. And we have a stronger logo. We are maintaining and strengthening the publication's identity. So there's some typeface differences, and the headlines give it a more contemporary look and an improved readability as well. We still have our familiar columns.
It sounds wonderful. Well, having been a librarian for many years myself, and because I had a professor in library school who was the president of SLA the year that I was in library school, mm-hmm. he lobbied all of us to join SLA.
Now, who was that?
Bob Malinowski.
Absolutely. Terrific.
Bob, from, I think he had been in Kansas and was then out at Libraries Unlimited for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because through the years when I would tell family and friends, I'm going to a special libraries meeting, they go, "What's a special library?" How would you answer that?
Well, I would say that a special library is a library or an information center or a resource center or a knowledge center, pick your favorite among those, that serves the mission of the parent organization, essentially providing information, managing knowledge that helps your parent organization work more effectively.
Very good. That's a great definition. What I often do in some of my classes is I will go to the SLA website and show them a list of the different divisions that are in SLA, And they are the students are amazed at the different types of libraries.
Exactly. And you know, Karen, it's a wonderful time whenever you're a student. I always encourage our students at Chapel Hill and any student who's thinking about being active professionally to join an association like SLA when they're a student. You can experiment. You can try a division. The very first division I joined was the Museums, Arts, and Humanities Division. And, in fact, I'm still a member today. I worked at the National Humanities Center, so it was a perfect match in terms of the types of programming and the newsletter and the other publications that that particular division has.
You know, now I'm remembering how I know you, because I was in that division many years. Some years ago.
A few years ago for both of us,
when
right?
When I met you, I said, I know you from somewhere.
That's it. It's MOD. It's,
yes,
it's
a small world for us.
Exactly. Well, one of the neat things about SLA is that truly, especially divisions, really change over time in terms of what we used to have a publishing division, for example, and as I'm sure you recall, it merged with Museums, Arts, and Humanities
yes.
division. The two of the newer divisions are the Competitive Intelligence Division and the newly created Knowledge Management Division. So it truly is a grassroots organization in terms of members deciding, wow, knowledge management is something that they're seeing in their business, their industry. They want to learn more about it. They get people together, go through the process and create a division, and then they can do programming at our annual conference, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, how long have you been in SLA?
1979.
Wow.
Yeah,
well,
a while.
You know, I think that I was a student, I think I was a student member back then around that time, too. So I might have been in almost that long, but not professionally that long. But you're only beating me by a couple of years, only by a couple of years. What are some of the positions that you have held in the Special Libraries Association?
Well, on a chapter level, I frankly have done almost every single thing, including bulletin editor to chapter president, and I'm still the archivist for the North Carolina chapter.
Oh, congratulations. That's
great. Yes. Let's take those archives digital. You know, that's one of the things that I enjoy talking to people about, and I was talking to some of our St. Louis members here about archives and where we're going next. So it's a fascinating time to be in the profession. In terms of SLA itself, I was the conference chair for the Cincinnati Conference in 1993. Done a lot of conference planning. I've been on the SLA board in terms of being the division cabinet chair. So just lots of different things.
Well, what I have often told library science students is they can get involved in any local professional library organization at any level, and several of the positions you mentioned, these are the types of things that they can at least start getting involved in now. Fortunately, some of our students from CISLT have started getting involved and have joined some of these committees on the local level.
That's
now,
wonderful.
Here in St. Louis, we do have another chapter across the state. I believe it's called the Heartland of America chapter that meets, a lot of them meet in the Kansas City area. And those are our CISLT students as well who will be listening to this broadcast. Speaking of trends, what kind of trends do you see emerging in librarianship right now?
Well, technology, of course, is one of the big drivers for our profession, and you begin to look at it. I was talking with some law librarians earlier today, and we were talking about basing your decisions on good information and the validity, and Google is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Wikipedia, all those things, and working on a campus, certainly we see students coming through and using those sources, but when you are looking for business information, you're looking at different sources, and if you're in an academic institution too, then you're looking for scholarly sources, and you need to be able to quote your sources. One thing that we had in the leadership meeting in Reno, Nevada in January, we had Chip Heath as a speaker. And he and his brother have written a book, which I would highly recommend to everybody. It's a business title called Made to Stick.
Made to Stick.
And essentially, they talk about how people learn and what people remember. And whether you're an information professional, if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, this is one of the best business books I've seen in a long time. And we were very fortunate to have Chip Heath join us and talk about the stickiness of ideas. And he said very clearly, in terms of he and his brother. His brother is has a teaching background and actually works for Duke University Corporate Education.
Oh.
Chip Heath is a professor at Stanford University, and in fact, he was interviewed last week on NPR. So
that's
very interesting. And he talks about what people remember in urban legends specifically. Sort of, there are many examples in the book. He talked about the tipping point because they, of course, borrowed from the stickiness idea from the tipping point.
I remember reading about that.
You remember reading about
it? Yes.
So it's a fascinating book, and I think this is a wonderful book for all of us to read, to talk to. To figure out ways, what's our story? What's the one story that when you're in the elevator with the CEO or the CIO or whomever your principal person is, whether it's a corporate situation or a university situation or a government situation, what story can you tell them that is going to stick? Essentially, it's a simple story. You know, this is an occupational hazard. One of the things that Chip Heath talked about was the curse of knowledge and how there is... We're all dealing with information overload, and he talks about the classic story of the gentleman who was out of town, and he ended up he had a drink in a bar with an unknown person, and this is the whole urban legend.
Okay, I'm ready.
You know, he ends up in the bathtub with the ice minus a kidney.
yes. I've heard that one.
Yes, exactly. A morality tale, if you will, about drinking with unknown strangers. But at any rate, along that line, this book is filled with, you know, seriously, urban legends and what people remember. And I think really that's one of the biggest challenges that we have as information professionals is getting our message across, the marketing, the branding, but being concrete. You know, man on the moon, let's the whole NASA piece of it, we're putting a man on the moon. Well, what do you do in your information center that's making a difference? And, of course, you'll appreciate this, too. I'm sure you remember him talking about burying the lead in terms of journalism.
I read a little bit about it, but I didn't read all. Could you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Essentially, in terms of burying the lead, it's Nora Ephron, and she's talking about in her journalism class and how she got to be a journalist. And essentially, long story short, she had a teacher in high school who was teaching journalism, and she was in California at that point in time. That's where she went to school. And long story short, she talked about how the class had a writing assignment, and their school, Margaret Mead was coming to speak, and all of the teachers were going to hear Margaret Mead's speech and a governor of California, et cetera, you get the idea there.
Yeah.
Well, everybody essentially took the two paragraphs of information, and they rewrote it, they handed it all in to this teacher. He looked at it, he just basically, in total frustration, drops all the papers on the desk and said, what you have done is you have buried the lead, because the important part is that school was out that day. That should have been the headline. And essentially, I think as information professionals, one of the things that we need to do is we need to promote ourselves, promote our services, and promote our skill sets. It's a great time to be in library and information science.
Well, and as you were mentioning earlier, Chip Heath spoke about the sticking point. That is the correct title, right?
Let's see. The tipping point
the
is
tipping
Malcolm
point.
Gladwell. And it's the book is called The Chip Heath and Dan Heath, and it's spelled H-E-A-T-H, just like a Heath bar, is called Made to Stick.
Made to Stick.
Made to Stick. It's getting a lot of press, and we were very, very fortunate just to have Chip Heath as a speaker. He did a wonderful job in terms of talking about tying urban legends. He's done a lot of research in terms of organizational behaviors. It's one of the most solidly researched piece of books I've seen in a while, but it's very readable. You don't have to, you know, be working on a research project to read this. You can just pick it up, put it down, and I think it has a message for all of us.
And in relation to libraries, you're absolutely correct. It's getting our message across
exactly. In
a concrete way. We have to decide what is the one story.
Exactly.
Well, first of all, if we're in a library, what is the one story that we want to get across to our community, our constituents, our clients, whatever the case is, and then how do we make it stick?
Exactly.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, in the book, I haven't read it through yet, but I understand that he explains how we can do this.
Exactly. He goes through several things. He talks about again, he starts off talking about urban legends, but he talks about the decision paralysis in terms of there's so much out there that you really, there is decision paralysis. But he talks about simple, that you want to just be simple in terms of overcoming the decision paralysis and getting the message across, and also unexpected. Like one of the things that I remember that sort of sticks, you know, Nordstrom's, they essentially wrote the book on customer service.
Yes, yes.
Okay, one of the things that he talked about under the category, the way he's arranged the chapters, was being unexpected and uncommon sense. Like now, and these are extreme examples, Karen, okay?
Uh-huh.
But very interesting. He talked about having a Nordstrom's customer who was talking about having a package wrapped, but the merchandise was from Macy's.
Interesting.
See? Uncommon sense, totally unexpected.
Whoa. Very, very interesting. Oh, that's great.
It's a great read.
And this is all tied in with libraries and librarianship.
Exactly.
This is wonderful. Well, so many times, again, getting back to SLA and the different types of career paths that students can take, that I've talked to many students about the different types of libraries but the different functions within libraries. They, again, I'm jumping back to SLA.
Sure, please do, yes.
That they didn't realize that there were such things as news libraries, as museum libraries, art libraries.
And I was at an architectural firm library today in St. Louis. Fascinating. I was at HOK this afternoon.
HOK Library.
Terrific.
They are into sustainable architecture.
Green buildings, LEED certification.
Very timely, especially after the Oscars. Very timely. Then, you know, there's so many different career paths that students can take, and again, I do try to tell them about all of them. What are some that you might suggest? Being the SLA president, you have mentioned some already, some directions that they can go, and of course, like I said, I tell them about the different types of libraries.
Absolutely. Well, there are many, many places that one can work, especially with the skill sets that our students are coming out with today, and you can do information architecture. You can work for the federal government. There are government libraries. It's a vast variety in the
military libraries.
Military librarians. Boy, what an active group we have. You know, one of the things I do, Karen, is I collect business cards as I travel.
Good.
And I'm really amazed at some of the variety that you see in job titles. I mean, you know, for example, let's pick something like webmaster. Well, that has morphed into lots of different titles, like web operations manager, e-business manager, web project manager, web technical administrator, or usability engineer. It's absolutely amazing in terms of where we're going. In fact, a student who graduated 2 years ago from the program at University of North Carolina gave a talk for the chapter in early spring, and essentially in her introductory material, her title in a corporate setting is Customer Experience Designer.
Customer Experience Designer.
Yes, and I'll tell you what she does. She works for a company. It's a private company, but she designs ringtones for your cell phone. So I'm telling you,
hilarious.
It is. It's a great time to have our skill sets. And, you know, I think we find, too, in libraries and information centers, there really is no such thing as a typical day. I've been very fortunate and have worked in several different environments. And, in fact, the very first library I worked for was a not-for-profit, the National Humanities Center. And it is a think tank in the Research Triangle Park. And I had the good fortune to essentially, I kind of look at it as, you know, that first job right out of graduate school.
That's a great job.
It was a great job. And I had a wonderful mentor. My very first boss was a role model and a mentor. And we did not have a gigantic collection, but he really inspired all of us to be a part of professional organizations. And so for me, that was SLA. And he said, you know, we don't have a physical collection, but we have staff, and he wanted to make a difference in the profession and give something back.
Very good. Speaking of being mentored, I know that SLA has a strong mentoring program. Would you like to say anything about that, about
their
mentoring program?
Certainly. I, you know, the mentoring occurs across chapters and divisions, and sometimes you end up seeing people only once a year at annual conference, and you pick right back up where you started. Or in terms of technology helping, too, with email, the distance, we transcend the distance. And so there are very natural, you meet someone and you may have the same problem to solve. It's at UNC, we're working on a new building, so I've been fascinated in terms of talking with some of the librarians here in St. Louis who've been through a construction project. So again, it's that whole sharing of we're on the same team, we're working towards some similar goals, and it's the whole networking. And that's it. Networking, with SLA, networking is the number one member benefit. Anybody that you talk to, and the surveys that we've done in terms of our members, will always cite historically networking as one of the best memberships.
I would definitely agree with that. The two major moves that I've made from one state to another, mm-hmm. from Oklahoma to Virginia and then to Missouri, each time I had an instant community.
Exactly.
With Special Libraries Association, because I would just transfer my membership from one state to the other, and instantly I would have a group of people who I had great fellowship with and also professional ties and so forth. I just had an instant community
in
each of those situations.
And that's what it's all about. And, you know, SLA is a global association. We are really... We're a little different in terms of some of our sister organizations because we do have members in 75 countries.
Well, in addition to what you were talking about earlier as far as the publication and so forth, what other plans are being made for the centennial in 2009? Or are they making such plans this
they
early
are.
On?
Actually, in last month in January, I announced the creation of an SLA Centennial Commission and Conference Committee for 2009. The SLA board created the group in December, and the group is charged with planning our annual conference and centennial celebration in Washington, D.C., which is really only 2 years from now. Dav Robertson from the NIAHS Library is the chair of the group, and we have set up an email suggestion box. It's 100@sla.org, so that members can send us email and share their suggestions and thoughts for celebrating our 100th anniversary in 2009, because we have lots of exciting ideas. In fact, I was talking with some of the law librarians from the St. Louis area about the centennial celebration that was held in St. Louis of AALL.
Yes.
So
what a grand idea. So any librarians can send an email to 100.sla.org.
Yes.
How is it again?
It is 100. It's the number
100@sla.org. @sla.org. And they can send their suggestions for
exactly.
the centennial.
Because we want to appreciate and reflect on the past and look at just how far we've progressed as a profession and as an association in the past 97 years, and it's very exciting to look at the next 100 years, so to speak.
That is so true. What do you find, and this is just kind of a fun question, what do you find is the most fun aspect of your job, and I'm calling it a job, but it's more a position, as the SLA president?
Oh, it's the chapter visits. It's talking
okay.
with members and talking to our students. That is absolutely one of the joys of the job. Now, somebody said, what's the challenge? And I said, airplane travel.
You know, yes. You
get in these little tubes. It's the same challenge that we all face, and I think, you know, it's you really do have to plan it. But
how often do you have to travel as SLA president?
2 to 3 times a month.
Well, that's not too bad.
No, it's not.
And how does this work out with your job as librarian at UNC Chapel Hill?
I am extraordinarily fortunate. I have a wonderful staff, and the university librarian is very, very supportive. And then on the home front, my husband and younger son are extremely supportive, and you know, the dog is still letting me in the house when I come home from the airport, so he hasn't forgotten who I am either.
Well, having been in the field, when you first started out as a librarian, let me ask this. As you first started out as a librarian, did you think you were going in a certain direction?
No.
I mean, you went with the
National Humanities
Center. Is that what you originally wanted to do?
Well, essentially what happened, and you know, the connections in library school that you make and the field experiences and practicums that you do, I can't emphasize the importance of that enough. Essentially, I was in school with a fellow who was planning to be a music librarian, and I worked part-time at the National Humanities Center, and we had some classes together. And essentially what happened is he had an opportunity to take a new job in a different town, and he and his wife lived in a different place, not that far away, but he decided that he'd rather do that. So his job became vacant. And so he said to me, well, you are going to apply, aren't you?
Wow. Oh, that's wonderful.
So sometimes you don't realize how lucky you are until it's in retrospect. Because at the Humanities Center, you know, you and I both remember when, down memory lane, when you had a physical collection and we did not have the web as we know it, and we had dialogue files, and I very quickly became an expert dialogue searcher. In fact, Bonnie Snow was one of the people who trained me.
Oh, my goodness.
On dialogue, and those skill sets and learning to think critically, and never, you know, there was no such thing as a typical day. We had questions from history to philosophy, and we had a great resource in using the libraries at the University of North Carolina, Duke University, and North Carolina State. You take those three collections together, and that's a substantial research collection.
That is, yeah, it's fabulous down there.
Exactly, and so being able to check out those materials directly for the scholars at the center was wonderful, but they had many more questions, Karen, that transcended the actual books and things like that.
I can
only imagine.
And
there were people like John Hope Franklin, noted historian, Bill Luchtenberg, another incredible historian. And in fact, Bill Bennett was our director. I worked for Bill Bennett.
The man who wrote the book.
You got it.
Oh, when I was in North Carolina, my anecdote, I did run into him at a one of those obscure ferries that goes across all the waterways down in North Carolina.
Yes.
And I wish I'd had the book with me so I could have him sign it. But
exactly. He's an interesting person in terms of the fact, you know, he has a JD and also a PhD in philosophy, so his reference questions were really interesting. And we handled some legal research-type questions for him at the center. So, again, the dialogue skills and figuring out, you know, how to use Dial Index and which files are your best files and things like that. And I was very fortunate because there was no such thing as a typical day at the Humanities Center. It was an excellent environment to work in. So I learned a tremendous amount. And my boss was an early adapter in terms of technology.
Oh, very good.
So
what
I ended up doing
that you
is,
had. Well, how did that segue into you working at Nortel and also well, at Nortel was the next place that you worked?
No, actually, there's a little software company called SAS.
Oh, okay. SAS, yes.
SAS, Statistical Analysis. Well, I had been at the Humanities Center for 14 years, and essentially I had used SAS on a mainframe to crunch the numbers for my master's paper.
Wow.
And so I think the reason they hired me is because I not only knew what it was, but I had actually used the software.
That's very helpful.
Yes. And so
all
I set up
skills count.
They really do. And the great news is that whatever your career path is, the skills are transferable.
Yes.
And so at SAS, I set up the corporate library there, and I was there for several years. And then Nortel came along and said, oh, gee, we have this we have a job and wonder if you're interested. And again, it was an SLA connection because honestly, career leads and things like that, it's all well and good. Things are advertised, but you and I both know from our respective careers that also knowing people,
yes,
knowing the
absolutely.
Local landscape, or if you're moving into a territory, it is so helpful to know SLA members.
To be well connected.
Exactly.
To be well connected within the profession and then on the periphery of the profession as well.
Exactly.
Because I know that you worked as a senior research specialist at Nortel Networks.
And we were a global
group. People don't
think
of librarians as being called senior research specialists.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what we were called. And essentially, there were 68 of us. There were 18 people in the Research Triangle Park, but we worked globally. And because, of course, Nortel is a telecommunications company, we did all of our meetings except once a year. We did them virtually and had a Polycom unit on the table, and so you were doing your meetings, weekly meetings via telephone, and it was a great time. We had a very neat database in terms of the virtual reference that we did. We covered about 21 hours out of 24 because we would rotate the reference coverage through the time zones. You know, we had a couple of groups in the UK, several groups in Canada, a group in Richardson, Texas, another group in California, and a group in Hong Kong.
And this was all via telephone?
That was the way that we talked with each other when we needed meetings, and, of course, email and that sort of stuff.
That's great.
Clients, say, for example, in the Research Triangle Park, we would often work with engineers in the UK because of the time difference. So they would submit a question via our database system, and we had a really cool database system at Nortel that we used to collect the questions. And then one of the things that I did in my job was to look at the search load that different people had within the group, and then I would direct. Think about being a kind of a traffic cop on the Internet,
and
direct questions over to different people, everything from questions about ruggedized handsets, in terms of the very sturdy industrial type phones, to Dun & Bradstreet profiles. We had quite a standards collection. The Telcordia standards collection at Nortel was pretty much legendary. We also had questions on bandwidth demand, all kinds of things.
You have certainly had a varied experience in the field of librarianship.
Oh yes,
and of course now you're a librarian at the
library school. And the graduate students, they're very kind, and they say, well, you're the librarian's librarian.
The librarian's librarian. That's very good. What are some of the things that you do there? What are some of your responsibilities?
Well, at the library school, I wear a lot of different hats, much like many of our SLA members. I have responsibilities in terms of directing that library. I do a lot of collection development, staff supervision. I do liaison with the faculty and the central library, lots of reference and research assistance and facilities as well. And in fact, it's very exciting because we are in a planning phase for a new building, and that includes a new library.
That it sounds like a very full plate that you have there, very
exactly.
Full plate. Well, having been in the field for a few years, would you choose to have stayed in librarianship all these years? I see that you had a variety of directions you've gone, but would you have chosen to stay in the field? You obviously have so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would. In terms of a personal philosophy, it's, you know, wanting to make a difference. And it depends on where you are in life and what other things are going. So you just want to decide where you want to go and where you want to be. And at this point in time, having worked in several jobs, Karen, what I feel I can bring to the table with our students is sharing that experience with them. And I know you're not going to be surprised. I'm the faculty advisor for the SLA student group at UNC. Big surprise,
right?
Very good.
Well, what bit of advice would you offer new library science graduates or soon-to-be graduates?
Well, what I would say is the skill sets that you have are transferable. And that even if one goes through, just be bold and go out there and take some risks. Our skills are so much broader that you can work in a wide variety of settings, whether it's corporate, academic, or government. So I would say that you're very, very fortunate. We live in an exciting time, and you should just go for it and join SLA.
Very good. Very good. Well, I'm just going to give you one final question. And I want to ask you, in your opinion, where do you think the field of librarianship is going now or in the future?
Well, I think we're going to more diversity in terms of the types of jobs that we do. We are going to reinvent ourselves. We are changing. We're already changing and moving into virtual space. So libraries, especially in corporate and academic settings and government settings, are reinventing themselves, and information commons, you know, right there on the rise, but we're changing to meet the needs of our customers. And
very good.
We have to remain relevant. That's the big thing.
Absolutely. We have to remain relevant. Well, thank you, Rebecca Varga, so much for your time and for spending a few minutes with us and telling us a little bit about what you do and about SLA. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Karen. I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon.
This is Karen Robinson with First Tuesday, and thank you for listening.